The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading Kicking the Football by Margaret Sessa Hawkins. You meet up with Lucy around a quarter past ten on one of the benches beside the football field. "Charlie Brown," she hails you in that Lucy voice, all authority and confidence. "How are you, Lucy?" you ask her, folding her in a tight embrace. She shrugs. "All right, I guess." "The truth is, things have been hard for you both recently. They've been hard for everyone in the Strip. It's been nearly two decades now since Charles Schultz died and Peanuts stopped running in the newspapers. Though you all still look like the same round-headed, poorly detailed children you've always been, you are, in fact, 67 years old now. You're all starting to feel your own mortality. Gradually, you know, the Strip reruns will stop appearing in the papers. Gradually, the books and collections that feature you will go out of print. Gradually, people will start to forget you, and you'll all begin the slow process of fading away. A lot of the characters are having a hard time with this. At Lucy's psychiatric booth, business is booming. But the whole prospect of an ending doesn't really faze you. You're carrying on pretty much as before. You're hanging out with the gang, you're feeding Snoopy, you're attending school and hoping that maybe one of these days you'll actually understand what it is the teacher is saying. It's not a wildly exciting life, but it's good enough for you. You are, in general, if not ecstatically happy, at least moderately content. And you've realized over the years just how rare and precious that is. So you shoot the breeze with Lucy. You exchange information about different members of the gang, and you talk about her business and Snoopy's latest rejection letter from the publisher, and a little bit about the dwindling comic market and how you both feel about that. But overall, it's just a really pleasant afternoon. An incredibly nice time catching up with an old and very dear friend. There's a football sitting next to her. It's been sitting there the whole time, leaning against her legs, white laces pointed toward the monochrome blue sky. She notices you glancing at it and smiles. "What are you thinking, Charlie Brown?" she asks with just a touch of cheek. You shrug. She takes the football in one hand and holds it up, looks at you, eyebrows raised. "What do you say? One more time, for old time's sake?" Many people in the Strip, okay, everyone in the Strip, has asked you multiple times why you keep doing this. "You know she's going to lift the football up and you'll fall flat on your back," they say. "Why even bother?" The thing they don't understand, the thing Lucy does not understand, the thing maybe no one, not even those stalwart everyday readers of Peanuts understand, is that for you it is not about whether or not you actually kick the football. It has never been about whether or not you actually kick the football. The truth is, there's this feeling you get when you are running across the field, this frisson of energy that builds inside you. In that moment, even though you know that it's almost certain that Lucy will remove the football, the sense of possibility bubbles up inside you until you feel you could burst with the excitement. And yes, it hurts a bit when Lucy removes the ball and leaves you sprawled on the ground. And yes, there's a sense of disappointment to it as well, a sense of being betrayed and let down. But it's worth it in the end. Because in the end, it really doesn't matter whether Lucy lifts the football up or not. What matters is that you are someone who will run full force towards the football and try to kick it, on the off chance that this time you'll launch it, despite every disappointment you've had in the past. This is what makes you Charlie Brown. This is the type of person you are, the type of person you always want to be. So you go through the whole routine. Lucy kneels on the uniformly green grass. She holds the ball firmly, upright on the absurdly flat ground. She looks at you, nods, smiles, and gives just the faintest of shrugs. You stare at the ball. You hold that image in your mind. Envision your foot connecting with it. Envision the ball soaring high above the field. You crouch down a bit, nod to Lucy, and then you are off, tearing across the grass, flying, running towards that football with everything you've got.
I'm Dan Oliver, reading This is the Story That Devours Itself by Michelle Munsler. This is not a regular story. This is a hungry story, built of words with tongues of glass and cracked marbles for eyes. You think you know this story. You think you've heard it before, but you haven't. It only sounds like the one you know, with its crunch, crunch, crunching of plot-laced bones and its smack, smack, smacking of fat story lips. There used to be characters in this story, but they were the first to go, swallowed down its story gullet. Two of them screamed and declared their eternal love for each other. The third one merely laughed and vowed one day to return. There also used to be a setting, not a very good one, mind you, but solid enough to serve its purpose. That, too, was eaten, mashed into a paste of generic trees and endless airports and washed down with a maudlin shot of rain. No one misses that setting, though, or the characters, if we must be totally honest. Certainly not the story, and certainly not me. To be fair, the story has tried to create as much as it has eaten, sucked sugar off three-act arcs until its head near exploded, molded fleshy outlines to show off to its friends when its friends still visited, only to debone the outlines hours later and watch their skins slough uselessly to the floor. Once it even tried dialogue, a casual, "Hello?" left adrift in the void where its apartment had been a week earlier. 51B, in case you were wondering. And no, nobody responded. The story also tried to liven things with mood and tone, with analogy and metaphor. It clung to rocky cliffs, peaked and pitted by tongues of salt, while seabirds wheeled tirelessly overhead. It heaved beneath the weight of olive trees, bowed with fruit, sweet oil dripping down its back. But that, too, is now gone. It's all devoured, most everything that made the story what it was, that told it what to be. All the bits chomped and chewed and swallowed into an over-masticated mush. Very little remains of the story now, just two simple elements. Its hunger and me. I must admit to being a bit selfish at this point. I've argued with the story for days about the importance of narrators. Without us, a story can no longer be a story. Somebody must tell the words, must provide perspective, relay the wishes of the story to the world abroad. Right? Yes, of course I'm right. I'm the narrator, after all, and I know my job better than anyone. But I saw the way the story eyed me last night. I saw hunger giggling in its ear while they both drank cheap wine created just for the occasion. The story didn't make wine for me, not even an empty cup. And now I've another invitation to visit the story tonight. It told me not to bother bringing a gift, to just bring myself, and don't be late. I tried declining. I did decline, but the words were swallowed before they left my mouth, consumed by the story's desire for completion, for resolution. So here I am, despite myself, all dressed up and only one place to go. The story is king, after all. And nobody, not even this poor narrator, can refuse that. Thank you.
My name is Evelyn Evans. This story is titled Foundering Fathers by Brian K. Lowe. Soames, you haven't by any chance solved those fourth dimensional differential equations of yours, have you? My valet's face remained impassive, but I had learned by now to read his eyes, which most would term steady, with perhaps a touch of stern, and they told me a sad tale of continuing futility. Not at this juncture, sir. And when, pray tell, might this juncture be located? Tasting the bitter fruit of experience had taught me that upon our present course, when was far more critical than where. The moment when we returned to the 26th century, I was going to seize one Cyril Bassington Santiago by the scruff of the neck and, public school chum or not, pitch him bodily into this infernal used time machine of his and set it on a one-way course to the late Pleistocene, which, knowing the fickle nature of the mechanism, it would never see. According to the chronograph, sir, Soames made a show of consulting the device. I took this as an uncharacteristic sign of his unease. Soames does not typically make a show of anything he does. We have emerged in the latter half of the 18th century. I shall know more precisely presently, sir. I despaired that his use of the word presently was a subtle attempt at humor, since for all of Soames' sterling qualities, jollity is absent from their midst. It would be funny in a gallows sense, since our present was also our past. Although, to be scrupulously correct, our future was also our past, right up until our present. I was thinking rather of the time of day, Soames. I find this undisciplined ratcheting back and forth in time parches the old Webster throat. In truth, though, I feared even Soames' ability to find the makings of a decent scotch and soda prior to 1900. Perhaps you should take the opportunity for a small perambulation, sir. Exercise does stimulate the brain. I thought it would be more productive for him to indulge in some mind-stimulating exercise while I remained behind in the relative comfort of the chronosphere, nursing a soothing beverage. Nevertheless, if my sacrifice could in any way grease the gears of Soames' marvelous thought processes, I was prepared to perform my duty for the greater good. I let myself out. We were ensconced in a shady lane off a dirt road. The sun was high, the sky was clear. Spying the outskirts of town, I strode forth to see the sights. It took some little time to reach the city center. The streets were crowded. Women carried shopping baskets on their arms, while dark-skinned servants in colorful scarves held parasols over their heads. Men in long coats and powdered wigs looked as uncomfortable as they did fashionable. My chameleon suit not only mimicked the local styles, it protected me from temperature and humidity. It did nothing, however, to protect my sense of smell, which was assaulted on every side. How fortunate that Soames had dispatched me to be my own Mercury on this errand, for among such a fragrance of humanity, I doubt he would have been able to do less than proclaim the establishment of a public bath directly here in the street. Such a declamation would doubtless constitute what my nanny would have protested as a really bad idea. Like the crowd, then, it seemed that the time to explore one of the nearby business establishments was ripe. No sooner did I direct my sight down the street than I espied a sign with a foaming tankard, and there I set my steps. There were only two patrons in the taproom, conversing quietly. I sat at a rough table and gestured to the nearest servant. A glass of your finest ale, my lady. The Webster men run more toward the genteel and cultivated than the classically handsome, but we have always made up for that with our scandalously fulsome bank accounts. I placed a local coin, supplied by Soames, via the ship's computers, on the table. And that's yours if I can count on your individual attention. Her eyes widened as she saw the coin. You can have as much of my ale as you like, sir, she said loudly, but we runs a respectable establishment here. She snapped up the coin and dropped it into her capacious bosom. dropping her voice to a stage whisper. "Me name's Annie." After a word with the barkeep, she headed for the stairs. I looked at her, then the barkeep, and finally at my empty table. "Well, sir, you paid for it. Aren't you going to use it?" One of the pair had turned to examine me. His friend wore an amused expression. When I frowned, the speaker pointed towards the upstairs where my waitress had disappeared. "Is that the private salon?" I asked. He laughed. "You could say that, sir. It's very private." Now, no one had ever accused the Websters of being megalocephalic, for which I had Soames, but neither are we bringing up the rear of the mob of human evolution. A light burst in my head. "Oh, heavens, I just wanted a beer. It's so hot." "Then you have overpaid handsomely, but Mr. Dawes and I would be honored to help consume your credit." He gestured at the barkeep. "Paul Revere, sir, at your service. And my colleague is Mr. William Dawes." I moved to their table, shaking hands vigorously. Hardly in town and already making friends. "Barclay Webster, so honored to make your acquaintance." Three tankards arrived. Mr. Revere made short work of his and ordered three more. When I offered to stake my new friends another round, he assured me that I had already done so. So I toasted their health, and they mine, and then the health of their friend George, and then a different George. And all the while, I blessed the 26th century medicines that would keep my blood alcohol level to no more than a pleasantly fuzzy level. "To Thomas Paine," Dawes roared, lifting his glass. "To Thomas Paine," we echoed, and we drank. "Barclay," Revere said, "I want to let you in on a little secret. Can you keep a secret?" I nodded slowly. "No Webster has ever betrayed a secret." Revere nodded too, and I thought his head would fall right off. "Good, because young William and I, and some comrades, are working on a bit of mischief that King Georgie would not like too much. A group of us thinks the colonies should secede and break away from Great Britain. What do you think?" "Are you talking about a rebellion? People could get hurt." Dawes hiccuped. "Good heavens, Paul, he's right. Did we even think about that?" Revere snored. "Oh, he's in for the night then," Dawes declared. And his own head promptly dropped to the table. But a hand from above caught him, lowering his face gently to the wood. "Soames!" "Good evening, sir. Will you be returning for supper or dining out?" "To be honest, Soames, my friends and I had not even contemplated supper. What time is it?" "Well, it's dusk, sir. And if it's not too much of an imposition, I was rather hoping you might be dining out tonight." I frowned, making the world fold in odd corners until I stopped. This ancient brew was quite heady. "Really, Soames? Is there some reason you wouldn't want me coming home? Have you a lady friend?" He nearly blinked. "Oh, no, sir. I was researching this time period." I stole a look at my two companions, but they were dead to the world. And it appears we have arrived at a very propitious moment. This is April 18th, 1775. On this very night, Paul Revere and his comrade, William Dawes, will undertake to warn their fellows of the encroachment of British troops, an event chronicled in a famous poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, long a particular favorite of mine. The opportunity to see the ride itself would be of great interest. All of the alcohol in my head immediately fled south, leaving me sober as a priest on Sunday. "Paul Revere, you say?" He did not register my apprehension. "Yes, sir. Not only is it the inspiration for a very fine poem, but it is a pivotal moment in the 18th century history. Fascinating on many levels, sir." "I say, Soames, allow me to introduce you to my two friends." I indicated the duo snoring on the table. This is Mr. William Dawes and Mr. Paul Revere. Soames' lips actually twitched. Oh, dear, sir, they must be awakened immediately. If they do not rouse the countryside, the colonist leaders, Samuel Adams and John Hancock, will be arrested by the British and summarily hanged. Hanged? Executed, sir. Executed? How barbaric. Indeed, sir, Earth's cultures were uniformly disposed towards barbarity in this period. In fact, matters did not markedly improve until the abolition of television in 2077. He turned to Dawes, slapping him lightly on each cheek. I followed his lead with Revere, but as Dawes had warned, there was no moving him. I appealed to Soames for one of his magic hangover elixirs. I fear, sir, that it only works on a gentleman after he has enjoyed several hours of sleep, and to force something down his throat now could choke him. By now Dawes was staggering around the room under his own power. What's going on? Who's he? Soames stood. I am a courier, sir, with reports of the British on the march. They are moving on Lexington. Dawes sobered on the instant. Lexington? They're coming for Adams and Hancock. This is what we've been waiting for. Come on, Paul, we... Oh, he looked at Revere, a sodden, snoring lump. I'll go myself. They must be warned. I'll go with you, someone cried. And with the utmost horror, I realized that someone had been me. Soames regarded me with a new light in his eyes. But whether it betokened a new respect or resolve to monitor my drinking more closely, I could not say. Dawes grabbed my arm to lead me outside. I sent Soames a silent plea for assistance. You proceed, sir, and I will attempt to rouse Mr. Revere. We may yet salvage the situation. Well, yes, that was easy to say when you were not running from armed troops, but such as my implicit faith in Soames that I had let it go. I had ridden a horse once, so I was at least peripherally aware of the mechanics. My lack of grasp of the finer points was instantly apparent to my mount. The night air being cool, I had wrapped a scarf around my neck, and, such as my horse's unbridled ruthlessness, that the scarf was blown into my face before I reached the next town. People scattered before me, and I tried to shout my message, so boisterous was my conveyance that I could not remove a hand from the reins for a moment. The I sputtered, but I despaired of any man comprehending a word of it. And then the scarf flew up into my eyes, and I could not even see. What did he say? I couldn't hear. Who was that masked man? I don't know, but I recognize the horse. It belongs to Paul Revere. Paul Revere? That must mean the British are coming. Others took up the cry, but I was borne away. The horse pounded through the countryside, carrying me like a sack of grain it would rather not be hauling. Somehow I avoided being dashed into a low branch. Whenever I heard voices, I repeated my cry, but whether my words were heard or lost in my scarf, which resisted my repeated efforts to dislodge, I could not be certain. Suddenly, we were slowing down. I managed to pull the scarf away, and there was William Dawes next to me, holding my horse's bridle. "It's done," he cried. "You have roused the entire countryside. Now you must ride to Mr. Adams and Mr. Hancock to warn them." I opened my mouth to reply that I didn't know Mr. Adams and Mr. Hancock from the President of Earth, but my words froze in my throat, and I could only stare. Dawes spun about to see for himself the cause of my consternation. "You will oblige us, sirs, by dismounting," said the man in the red suit and jolly hat. His odd costume was rendered far less ridiculous by the dozen others in similar attire who wielded what appeared to be quite nasty armaments, whose air of martial antagonism was only accentuated by the long pointed metal spikes that each sported at its end. The end, I might add, that was pointed towards us. We did precisely as we were bid. No sooner were we rudely ushered into place, however, when there came another disturbance. "What is the meaning of this? Who is in charge here?" And striding out of the darkness into the knot of soldiers decked out in the most outlandish red uniform with epaulets, white belt, buckled sword, and topped with a white wig, was my own man, Soames. Dawes started to speak, but I shushed him. "I'm in charge, sir. Sergeant LeBrand, sir." "Well, Sergeant," thundered Soames, "I am Major Soames, and in the event you did not receive the order, the Colonials are resorting to their old tricks and are headed south. All available units are to report to Colonel Webster immediately for new orders." "Colonel Webster, sir?" "I don't know him, sir." Soames somehow loomed even taller. "Don't know him? Well, he certainly will know you, Sergeant, if you don't turn around and do a double-quick march back to Boston." "But my prisoners, sir, will be taken into my custody. Now move, you impudent lout, unless you want to join them." In the blink of an eye, the troops retreated, leaving me grinning like a loon, and Mr. Dawes asking himself where he'd seen Major Soames before. When Paul Revere, miraculously steady on his feet, appeared at Soames' side, my poor friend William was completely out of his orbit. Revere and his horse were soon reunited, and with Dawes, off to warn the Colonials' leaders. Soames led me to our chronosphere. "How did you get Revere into the chronosphere, and what did you tell him it was?" Soames permitted himself a ghost of a smile, although in the dark I might have been mistaken. "Given Mr. Revere's state, sir, it was a simple matter to persuade him that anything he thought he saw was a product of his own imagination." "And how did you find us? Without you, the British might have..." I thought about his earlier use of the term hanged and fingered my collar. "That was entirely due to your own efforts, sir. You had so thoroughly alarmed the countryside that charting your course was simplicity itself." "I was impressed, if I might be so bold, sir, at your ingenuity in preserving your own identity and promoting the concept that it was, in fact, Mr. Revere who was riding through the entire time." I lifted my chin and shot my cuffs nonchalantly. "In times of urgency, one rises to the occasion, Soames. Websters are known for their composure under pressure." "Of course, sir. May I prepare you a nightcap? Your bed has been turned down." "Thank you, Soames. I must say, for all the congeniality of the local population, their taste in beer leaves much to be desired. It is a barbaric age, sir."
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.